live in a series of 1,000 shiurim in living with your teenager. One of the most frequent questions that I'm asked by mechanchim and rabbonim and concerns parents regarding the problem of rebellious teenagers in our community is whether the proliferation of problem teenagers among us is merely proportionate to the population growth of our community, or it's growing in greater proportion than the population of our community. In other words, is it just because there are so many teenagers that a greater proportion of them are rebellious and therefore more noticeable, or is there really something wrong? Now, there's no question, there are no two ways about it. It is a black and white, open and shut issue. The proliferation of rebellious teenagers in our community is above and beyond merely proportionate to the population growth of our community. Firstly, it's a mathematical and logical absurdity, knowing the facts that we do, to assert that our problem teenagers are merely the result of a expanding community. And the logic is quite simple. We all know that during the years when our community swelled, the decadence of society, the depravity of society, has become much more severe. All of us who graduated high school a generation ago know that the societal influences, the streets, the televisions, the movies, the newspapers, the radios, the outdoors are much, much lower, much worse than they were when we were teenagers. Or it's much worse than it was even 10 years ago or even 5 years ago. How many times do we have to repeat the fact that a generation ago when a 8th grade teacher gave the students a current event assignment, they would go to the front page, let's say, of the New York Times to find something about the Vietnam War, Kennedy's, whatever, a moon landing. And now, what do you have on the front page of the New York Times that's considered current events? You have a Clarence Thomas trial, you have an O.J. Simpson, this is current events. Now, we as adults are able to contrast what's going on now with what was going on then, so, and therefore we are able to perceive the contemporary obsession with Hashchosa as just that. But our children conceive this obsession with Hashchosa as current events. A boy going to yeshiva from his home, a bus passes by, bam, all he has to do is take one look and he gets an education in Hashchosa more serious than his father did all his years in high school. When we were teenagers, our rebbeim were not happy if we listened to the radio, especially if we listened to the goyish music. I'd like any parent to visit a record store nowadays and see how far the decadence has reached in the medium of non-Jewish, of secular music. It's mind-boggling, and I'm not exaggerating. Even the most tolerant liberal would have his hair stand on edge by walking in to a regular record store in a regular mall around the corner and take a look at the titles and the covers of the records and the words and the messages that they're giving over. You can't turn on the radio nowadays. Not that it was a big mitzvah a generation ago, but it's a million times worse nowadays. And there's no question that the decadence of society is a primary contributor and a primary cause to the problem of wayward youth among us. There's no question about it, that society's influence takes its toll. And therefore, basic arithmetic tells us that a problem grows not merely proportionate to the population that has the problem, but a problem grows in proportion to the cause of the problem. And if the cause of the problem is greater, then the problem is going to be greater. If we would have the same level of society that we had 20 years ago, but a greater population of Fruma Yidden, then you could argue that the proliferation of problem teenagers are in proportion to the population and no greater. But being that the cause has become more severe, regardless of the population, that is a factor that must be taken into consideration when we try to understand how serious the problem is and how widespread it has become. This is simple arithmetic. A problem swells in proportion to the cause. And if the cause swells besides the population, then you're going to have that factor to consider as well. Anybody that tells you that the problem of wayward youth among us is only in proportion to a swelled population, it's absurd. It's absurd. You can see for yourself. You take a yeshiva that's existed for over 20 years, and you take that same yeshiva. We don't have scientific statistics. It's very hard to be able to generate such numbers. I'm working on a project to do that. But we don't have scientific statistics now, but we can use our seichel. If we take mainstream yeshivas 20 years ago and now, and you figure out how many more students there are than there were then, and how many more problem students there are in the same yeshiva greater than what was then, you will find that almost across the board, the population of problem students is greater proportionately than the increase in the amount of students. And that's the mainstream yeshivas. Don't forget, there are many non-mainstream yeshivas where that have a greater proportion of at-risk youth among their student body than these mainstream ones. And so, there's no question. There are no two sides to the story. It is a black and white, open and shut issue that the problem is growing. Another reason why the problem is growing, beside the problem of the societal influences, is a social one. And that is this. Adults are not always sure of themselves. And for an adult to take a stand for what he feels is right, to buck the system, to swim against the tide, is considered a courageous and rare act of idealism. Because nobody feels comfortable being different than everybody else. Also, if an adult wants to involve himself in something that he shouldn't be involved in, it's much easier for him to cross the line between right and wrong if there are other adults doing the same thing. Cheating on taxes and speaking Lashon Hara and various other moral indiscretions would be a lot more uncomfortable for us to commit if there wouldn't be so many people doing it. We figure, well, everybody's doing it, so it just becomes emotionally easier for us to do. Teenagers are even more peer-oriented. And if there is an act of moral indiscretion that a significant number of others are committing, it will be that much easier for the teenager himself to be involved in it. Everybody's doing it, right? If everybody's doing it, that itself to a teenager becomes a hoiroas heter. Certainly, at the very least, it becomes a tremendous yetzahara and tremendous temptation. Therefore, if we are going to assume for the sake of the argument that the problem of wayward youth is merely a result of a proportionate number of problem youth in an expanded and enlarged population, what would happen, and what has happened in our population, is that for whatever reason, there are a significant number of teenagers that are dropping out of school. There is a very noticeable group of teenagers who are involved in criminal activity, rebelliousness against Frumkeit, and the conspicuousness of their existence automatically becomes a temptation in the Yetzirah for other teenagers. Therefore, even if we are to submit to the absurd notion that the problem is only a result of swelled numbers in the population, we would also have to concede that the proportionate enlargement and proliferation of these teenagers create a new Yetzirah, because if you only have one or two teenagers doing something, that doesn't mean everybody's doing it. That doesn't mean it's acceptable. But if you have 100 teenagers doing it, even if the population is much, much greater, the fact that there is a group of people doing it that's that big becomes automatically temptation. They become a gang. And that itself is an extra Yetzirah. An extra Yetzirah means another contributing factor to the problem. And therefore, this evening's discussion is going to be on the very important topic of how to deal with your teenagers' negative influences. Because the negative influences are a tremendous factor. And the first reason is what we just said. Teenagers have an attitude, adults do too, but teenagers more so. If everybody's doing it, it becomes okay. Now, this is why adults talk in shul. This is why they speak Lashon Hara. This is why they cheat on taxes. Everybody does it. We've heard it from our peers, our adult contemporaries. But unfortunately, well, you'd be shocked to hear what our teenagers claim everybody is doing these days. I've had a 16-year-old girl tell me last week that she sees no reason to stay in school because nobody's in school nowadays. This is a quote. Everybody's dropping out. Nobody's in school anymore. Now you're all snickering because we know that the schools are overpopulated. But you know what? So are the pizza stores and the movie theaters during school hours. And if the people who are populating the streets during school hours are the primary acquaintances of this particular teenage girl, that's the impression she's going to come out with. Nobody's in school nowadays. Everybody's dropping out. I've heard it used as a hoiroas heter regarding stealing cars. Only stealing cars, everybody does it. You're laughing. Just wait till you get to Shemayim and Hashem asks you about your Lashon Hara. And you say, well, everybody was doing it. He'll give you the same laugh. Children are not much different than we are. just different applications of the same perversions. I've heard it used regarding credit card fraud. Credit cards, everybody's into that. And you'd be surprised, you'd be shocked and flabbergasted at the extent of how far this taina can and is used by our teenagers. There are many ways negative peers, bad peers, influence a child. And we're going to go through them one by one. And this is way number one. If enough peers are doing something wrong, a child gets the idea that the act isn't so bad because, quote unquote, everybody's doing it. That's the first way that negative peers can have an influence on their friends. Now, we're going to explain what to do if this happens to you, or to prevent it from happening to you. First thing we have to know is that it's the hardest thing in the world to separate a child from his friends. And even if it can be done, the parents are in the weakest position to be able to do it. You try to tell your son or your daughter, stay away from this person who's a bad influence. Now, your son is good friends with this boy. Who knows him better, you or your son? Well, your son knows him better. You probably know very little about him. He's going to tell you, this is what, you heard it here. This is what he's going to tell you. Do you know this boy? You don't even know him. How could you say such a thing? You'll say, well, what I know about him is enough. And he'll say, no, it's not. I know him better than you do. And he's not as bad as you think. And he's not influencing me. And don't you trust my judgment in friends? Don't you trust me? Can't I choose my friends? What am I, a shoita, that I don't know how to choose a friend? What am I, going to do something that's destructive to me? I'm such a baby that I need my mother and my father to tell me who I should choose as friends? Isn't that the most basic psychological and emotional right that a child has, a teenager, to choose his own friends? It's the hardest thing in the world, and parents are in the weakest position to do it. What you need to do instead of trying to get rid of the negative influence, because, now if you can, gesunte hate, go for it. If your child's going to listen to you and you say, you know your best friend, stop associating with him, and he'll say, yes, mommy, no problem. I will no longer associate with him. He'll go rip out the telephone number from the phone book, and he'll go erase it from his little computer phone book. No problem. But if you are in 90% of the population that doesn't have this control over their children, what you have to try to do, instead of taking away the friend, trying to break him up with his friend, is try to negate the individual components, the individual reasons why a bad friend can have a negative influence. And so, reason number one is because the child says everybody's doing it. And the antithesis of this, the way to combat it, is as follows. The only reason why a child will say everybody's doing it is because a child looks at his immediate vicinity to determine who is everybody. For a child to say everybody's dropping out of school, that means that a child's primary companions or primary acquaintances, his primary encounters, have a significant amount of dropouts among them. A child who always hangs around with dropouts, even if it's only a handful of people or less, is at great risk for coming up with the statement, nobody's in school nowadays. Because people in general, and children and teenagers especially, have a tendency to judge the world by their own little dalaramas. Didn't the Benois Leutz make that mistake? They thought there was nobody else in the world. Because they thought what happened in their dalaramas was an accurate picture of everything in the entire planet. And it's the same thing with children, with our teenagers. They think that what's going on in their Dalet Amos is just a reflection of what's going on in the world. And so if what's going on in their Dalet Amos is dropping out of school, everybody's doing. Nobody's in school nowadays. So therefore, what you have to do is, you have to import, you have to expose your children to as many positive influences as possible. Now, your child doesn't have to be friends with these positive influences. All he has to do is encounter them. Invite them for Shabbos, encourage relationships, whatever you can do, even if it's not a bond going to develop between your child and these positive people. As long as your child is exposed to positive influences, even if they don't influence him per se, because they don't really bond, they don't have much of a relationship, but at least this factor, everybody's doing it, will no longer exist. Instead of trying to remove those that are doing it, try to add instead people who are not doing it. And even if they will not have a relationship with your child, even if they will not bond with him, exposure to these people, exposure to a great amount of people that are in school on a daily basis. If a child has a job, who you invite to school, which of your friends whose children will frequent your home, your own friends' children. All he has to do is be exposed, encounter these people, know of their existence. Not just peripherally, oh yes, I heard something, a rumor in the street that there are people that go to school out there. People that are part of his life. And again, we're not talking about people who he's going to be friendly with, people who he's going to hang around with. We're talking about people who are part of the picture of his life. People who end up coming to his house. If you have another child within the same age group, get that child to bring friends over that will get to know the problem teenager, the objective of all this being to negate the idea that everybody's doing it. Yeah, all your friends are doing it, but not everybody is doing it. And meaning not everybody who you know, not everybody in your life, not everybody who you encounter, not everybody who you're exposed to does it. Throw in people that don't do it into the picture. As many as you can. Let them hang around your house. Babysit, whatever. Most parents think, or many parents, that such an idea is an exercise in futility, because if you tell them, well, bring in a good influences to the child, they'll say, my son doesn't like these good influence type people. Regarding this particular component of negative influence, it doesn't matter if he likes them or not. It doesn't matter if he bonds with them or not. All that matters is he is exposed to them. And that will be sufficient to negate this particular component of negative influence. Because in order for this component to live, it has to live in a vacuum. Everyone's doing it only exists in a vacuum. Instead of trying to pull your son out of the vacuum, fill it with other things so it won't be a vacuum anymore. This is just an example of how to combat a negative influence without trying to rip the two friends away from each other. Because ripping doesn't work. Now there are more components of negative influence, and we're going to go through them one by one. Another way bad friends negatively influence a child can be seen in a Gemara, famous Gemara. And it asks, Lama nismacha parshas nazir parshas soita? Why is it that the chapter of Nazir is right next to the chapter of Soita in the Torah? And it says, because im roya adam soita bekilkaluha, if a person sees a soita, a disgraced woman, a woman who is accused of adultery, in her disgrace, yazir atzmai min hayayin, he has to be careful, be extra careful in his frumkeit and become a nazir. And all the mafarshim ask the question, they say, what do you mean? If a person sees the downfall of the guilty, he needs to be careful less than the average person. If you see a guilty person prosper, or you see an innocent person disgraced, then your frumkeit can be shaken. Like Acher, that potential tzaddik who saw the tongue of a big tzaddik, Chutzpah Samaturgaman, being dragged in the dirt, and that destroyed his frumkeit. But if you see a disgraced, guilty party, why would that shake your frumkeit? That shows justice from Hashem. You know what the answer is that they give? The answer is, even if you see the guilty suffer, the criminals get punished, but as long as you see the criminals and you see the crime, it has a negative impact on you. There are certain things, immorality, criminal activity should be unspeakable and unthinkable to our children. It should be shocking. It should make their hair stand on edge. Being exposed to it, even in a positive way, meaning Saita Bakilkalua, takes away the shock of it. If you see it once, if you see it twice, it's less unthinkable to you. You become more used to it. Two examples that I gave here before in another context. The Chafetz Chaim wanted to move once away from his little town of Radin to a big city called Riga. And he did so for 2 weeks. After 2 weeks, he said that the influence on him is so bad he has to move back to Radin. What was so bad? He saw Chilul Shabbos. In Radin, you didn't see Chilul Shabbos. It was a little town, I guess. The streets didn't have any busy thoroughfares, didn't have a lot of traffic. And it was a nice, quiet little town. But Riga was like New York. You live on Ocean Parkway, you're going to see cars driving by. They asked the Chafetz Chaim, if that's the case, if Shabbos was your problem, why did you last 2 weeks? What about the first week? Ochil Shabbos then too, didn't you? And the Chafetz Chaim said, yes, I saw Ochil Shabbos the first week, but it shocked me. I was appalled. It made my skin crawl. Ochil Shabbos? He wasn't used to seeing it. The second week, he said, I was shocked just a little less. My skin crawled just a little less because I was just so much used to it. Just a little used to it. And that's the time to leave. And this is the Chafetz Chaim. The Rosh Yeshiva from the neighborhood here told me that he once went with his Rebbe, Rabaron Kotler, to collect money from a certain gevir. And when they entered his house, they saw on top of the fireplace was mounted a musket, a rifle. Baron started shaking. And he grabbed this Rosh Yeshiva, who was then a bacha, by his arm, and he said, take me out of here. He said, a gun. The Baron said, a bix. He said, a gun. It's an instrument of murder. He got shocked. And he couldn't be there with a gun. Anybody who watches television nowadays, anybody who has a magazine, anybody who grows up in America, loses that sensitivity that Rabban had. Don't kids wear bullets around their necks regularly? And so there's a certain sensitivity, a negative sensitivity, that people have towards bad, that's dulled and blurred by having peers that are involved in such activities. I've had teenagers tell me, once upon a time, I used to think that smoking on Shabbos, getting worse and worse, smoking drugs on Shabbos, was terrible. Now I see it's not so bad, everybody's doing it. Not that it's right. But all right, it doesn't make so much of an effect anymore. Because the friends are doing it. Even if this girl does not take a cigarette, a Marlboro cigarette in her mouth, ever, She was affected by her friends because she no longer possesses that sensitivity, that perception of how unthinkable such an act really is. That is the second way negative influences affect our children. The antithesis of this problem is to explain to your children clearly that just because you're getting used to something doesn't mean that it's not shocking. You have to explain to them the nature of a human being. That there are people, listen, there are doctors in the hospital who are so used to death, they become so callous that it means nothing to them. A dead one, a live one, they can joke about it. Rahman al-Islam, I know if I, Rahman al-Islam, saw a dead body, I'd faint. A dead body? Somebody that sees it every day is nothing. No big deal. You put a check or an X on the chart, whatever it is, and you go further. There's certain things that, although they're shocking, they lose the shock effect. It's a Gemara. Gemara says that if the Yetzer Hara comes to attack a person, Gemara in Brachas, he should learn Torah. He should say Shema. He should do various different things to combat the Yetzer Hara. And if nothing works, he should pull out his ace in the hole. He should be Maz Ki Yoim HaMoves. He should remember that one day he's going to die. Now, everybody who reads this Gemara raises his eyebrow and says, wait a minute. If remembering the day of your death is the ace in the hole, if that's your best cannon, why don't you shoot it immediately? Why do you have to go through Torah and Shema? Why didn't the Gemara say that if the Yetzer Hara comes to you, remember, you're not going to be here forever. You're going to die. And that's it. Is it expensive to use, that you have to use it as a last resort only? Why do we wait to use our best gun last? You know what the answer is? The answer is that remembering death can shock a person into doing tshuva. But if he does it all the time, he gets shocked less and less. You see, learning Torah, saying Shema, the more you do it, the more an effect it has on you. As you get used to saying Shema, as you get used to learning Torah, as you get more into it, you relate to it more and more, and it has a greater and greater effect. But remembering that you're going to die, that's shock effect. First time it'll work a lot, the second time a little less, the third time a little less, and therefore, you only use it in emergency situations, because if you use it every day, and you need something to use every day against the Yetzer, it'll eventually lose its potency. We have to explain to our children that once upon a time, they would be shocked at certain vulgar language. And now, because all of their friends use it and they're used to it, and it doesn't shock them anymore, does not mean that the language is any less shocking. It's not a new revelation that they now found that these words, this language isn't as shocking as they thought it was, but rather on the contrary, you become blind, you become used to something that you should be shocked over. You have to explain this to them clearly, make them understand. They will look at their new attitude as a revelation, as an education. Now I see it's not so bad. Wrong. You used to be able to feel the truth. Now you became used to it and it's not so. And explain to them its nature. Ask a doctor in a hospital. Death should shock a person. It's more effective to go to a funeral than it is to go to a wedding. Because a funeral will shock a person into realizing that he has to straighten out. But somebody that goes to funerals every day, you go to a funeral director, it doesn't have an effect anymore. What does that mean? That means we're all wrong and death is really nothing. And he knows what he's talking about. His feelings, his chushim, his senses are really represent reality? No. Anybody can get used to anything in this world. Just because you get used to something doesn't mean that that thing is any less shocking, any less unthinkable. We have to explain this Rachel Bitcha Ktana to our children, and usually they will understand. Another way, another component of a negative influence is that it negates loneliness. It's in human nature that human beings are gregarious creatures. What it means is they need other people in order to survive emotionally. We need food and water and shelter to survive physically, and we need other people to survive emotionally. For example, imagine you were in high school, you're a teenager, and you have to work hard to get good marks. And you work hard. And you study long. And you go over your work. And you put in all your effort and concentration into it. And when the report card comes, it's all A's. Come home, and there's nobody to show that report card to. Imagine you have nobody to share that with. Imagine a yosem. Imagine a stranger, imagine a hermit. He has nobody to share that with. What is it worth to him? Tell me, if you could go to the moon and back on the condition that nobody in the world would ever know, nobody would ever know, would you do it? You wouldn't be able to, nobody would know you ever went. You see, people need emotional feedback from others. They need to share their simchas. They need, if Rachmon al-Itzlan, it's not a simcha, they need other people to be menachem them. It's the nature of human beings. Teenagers need it even more. They are so much in a state of confusion, in a state of nishtahin, nishtaherness, in a state of half semi-adult, semi-child, that for their own emotional confidence and stability, they need to know that there are other people there with them. And so parents make a very big mistake. It's an error. When a child comes home and they did something wrong, the child says, well, so-and-so did it and we did it with them. And he said, if so-and-so would jump off the roof, would you jump off? You know why that's a mistake? Because the answer is yes. If so-and-so, if his friends would jump off the roof, he would. You know why? Because he'd rather be down there, dead with everybody else, than on top of the roof alone, if everybody else is down there. He'd rather be down there with everybody else dead, than alone, standing at the edge of the roof. So you ask him, if they jump off the roof, would you do that too? The answer is, of course he would. He may not be able to understand it well enough to admit it, but he knows he would. Loneliness is worse than death for a teenager. And so, when negative influences appear, it provides the child with a way to alleviate this natural loneliness. That's the byproduct of teenage confusion. Try to separate a teenager from his friends is often perceived by the teenager as an attempt to exile him into a state of loneliness. And no matter what the cost, he will not allow that to happen. Now, this is a reason why children stick to negative influences, even though they know that it's self-destructive. Parents often don't understand, why is my child hanging around with these people? he knows that they're schlepping him down. The answer is he'd rather be schlepped down with people than not be schlepped down alone. And therefore, the antithesis to wean him away or wrench him away from those influences. That's so hard to do. Rather, try to find, by hook or by crook, by begging or bribing, find positive influences to enter the child's life. People who will spend time with him, people who will care for him. Sometimes, parents themselves could provide that. More often than not, though, it's going to have to be another friend, another group of friends. But rather than try to separate him from the negative influence, you got to provide for him a positive one. And then, once he's receiving this nurturing, this sense of camaraderie from the positive influences too, then you can approach the child and try to break him away from the negative ones. But you can't do it and leave him in a vacuum. You have to first provide him with something else and then take it. You can't leave him in a vacuum. And so, we've discussed this evening a number of ways, a number of different dimensions, dynamics of negative influence. And we discussed how to deal with it, what to do rather than try telling the kid, you're not going to see this friend again. Sum up, negative influences create an everyone's doing it attitude, against which exposure to people who aren't doing it is usually sufficient to eliminate that attitude. Negative influences dull a child's desperately needed sensitivity towards the severity of the immoral act. And to combat that, you need to educate the child that his new attitude is not an education, it's not a revelation, but rather just a natural result of getting used to something he shouldn't be used to. And the third thing is, it solves his need for companionship, and it eliminates the loneliness that's so frightening to teenagers. Rather than take away the bad influence, there you have to provide him with substitutes. Much more often than not, the way to get a child away from his bad friends is to focus on the positive and not the negative. Let the child build up his own virtues and his own talents and his own self-image such that he'll wake up one day and say, hey, what am I doing with these people? There's a 15-year-old girl who I've been dealing with who dropped out of school and she was associating only with peers who dropped out of school. There were those who felt that we should first separate her from her friends and then send her back to school because as long as she's with her friends, they have a pull on her and they won't allow her to be successful in school, it won't last. I said it'll never work. Because if you're going to wait for the time that she breaks up with her friends to send her back to school, she'll be an old lady before she gets her high school diploma. Send her back to school. Don't worry about the friends. Build up her image. Let her do good in school. Let her teachers praise her. Let her create bonds with them. Let her associate with positive influences in school. And eventually, v'kach hava, and this is exactly what happened, she turned around and said, I prefer these friends to those. You see, don't forget, a child and an adult, but especially a child, sometimes can't see exactly where their friends are holding. They can't see how bad they are because they have nothing to contrast them to. If you have two friends, one's a very positive friend and one's a very negative friend, it becomes very clear to you how negative the negative one is and how positive the positive one is, because you're comparing. But if all you have are negative friends, it's very hard, very often, for a child to be able to perceive exactly how bad an influence these friends are, because there's nothing to contrast them with. Once they have positive peers, and in the example that I just gave, it was almost inevitable, because when a child goes to school, the need for people to do your schoolwork with and to interact regarding schoolwork will create relationships with more positive peers. Suddenly she begins to see, hey, I just hung up the phone with Rachel, and now I'm going to call Vito. She begins to see a contrast, and she begins to notice, the blurry picture starts shifting into focus, and she starts thinking, hey, what are these people, and who am I? And assuming the child has a reasonable amount of seichel, more often than not, they will break away with the old peers. Focus on the positive. Friends are the hardest thing to separate. They're focused on the positive. The more you build the child up, the further you're bringing the child from the friends. Eventually, they're going to break off. At this point, the way we do it over here is questions are written down on a piece of paper and handed to Henry, who brings them up, and then we address them. Question. We mentioned the outside culture as an aggravating factor for the problem of rebellious teenagers. What about a family who's already doing a lot to shelter their children from this culture? Should more be done? And the answer is yes, but not necessarily in the direction of sheltering. Sheltering is very good, but one of the principles, one of the cornerstones of our philosophy in this area was a statement of my Rosh Hashiva, Rabbi Yitzchak Kuttner, to one of the Rebbeim in Chaim Berlin, where he told him that your child will see more tumah going to the grocery store on the corner to buy a Coke than your grandfather did all his life in Europe. Therefore, trying to shelter him will not work. You have to teach him to deal with it. Now, that doesn't mean that you should not try to shelter him as well. What it does mean is that you can no longer rely on it. Because if your child goes to a yeshiva, well, theoretically he may remain sheltered. If he goes to a yeshiva without any other bacharim, without any English teachers, if he walks to school and doesn't meet any friends, and he has blinders on his eyes and earplugs in his ears, if when he comes home he doesn't turn on a radio, doesn't see a newspaper, if he has no friends or acquaintances or siblings, then it's possible to shelter him. If any of those factors are not so, you're going to have to also add a strong dose of training rather than sheltering. We have to explain to our children what the bad influences are, why they are bad influences. Leitzanusa da avoydezara comes in very handy here. If we show our children that the society is not something to follow, to look up to, but rather something to look down on, and what kind of mishugana would want to buy into this stuff from an early age, it will get through to them. Now, this is easier said than done. And I'll give you a classic example. How we live in a society that worships youth. The Torah doesn't have that attitude. Neseva talking by us. An older person, a person with experience, is deserving of respect, not to be relegated to a nursing home. Not to move aside for somebody young and dynamic. How many parents, how clear is it to the children that the parents feel bad that they're growing older? That they wish they were the same age as their children again? How many times does a father kvetch because he found another white hair? White hair is a sign of respect. When a son tells a what happens when the mother's 40 years old on her 40th birthday? And that day she doesn't want to get out of bed. She wants to crawl under the bed so nobody sees her. She's 40. Rahman al-Itzlan. How deeply rooted is this trefa part of our society in our mentality? You're talking about sheltering a child from it. Here's a very good example. We're in a from home. Very often you have society. And if parents are jealous of the child, that means technically the child's a superior in a way. And then comes chutzpah. You're telling me what to do? I'm a young, dynamic teenager. You're over the hill. It's an attitude. You wish you were like me. You wish you were my age. I should have rachmanis on you because you're old, so I should listen to you. All goes through kids' heads. Parents have to have an attitude that they, if you want to be an authority, you have to really believe that you are, I don't want to use the word superior, but that you are the more experienced and that you have what to tell the children. And that one day you want to bring up the children to be like you, as opposed to you secretly praying desperately that you are still like your children. What did one of those goyim say? It's a pity that youth is wasted on the young. When I was a kid, I used to say it's a pity that experience is wasted on the old. It works both ways. But the Torah view is 1,000% clear. That statement about experience being wasted on the old is a product of a young whippersnapper. But according to the Torah, this is our attitude. That's just one example. There are so many examples of this. Society is, you want to shelter your child from, so forget it, it's not going to work. You don't have to bring immoral pictures into your home, but you can't rely on sheltering. You have to teach a child societal literacy. How to read society, how to understand it, the dynamics of it, why people are the way they are, why we worship youth, that it's Madison Avenue's way of selling more bottles of oil of Olay. Our children have to understand the absurdity and the stupidities of our society. They have to be able to laugh at it and look down at it. Because, objectively speaking, it is absurd. We are locked in the grip of the Madison Avenue magicians who pull us on the leash this way and that way, and we run, we follow accordingly. It's a joke. Your children would watch your Chasana movies. I guarantee now, I never saw any of your Chasna movies. And I wasn't there when your children saw it. Tell me if I'm wrong. They took a look and said, Mommy, my gosh, you had weird hairstyles in those days. Right? That's exactly what they do. What makes it weird? Because somebody told them that nowadays, what they did 20 years ago is weird. Wait till their children watch their Chasna movies. They'll say the same things. What's weird, what's normal, what's insane, is all brainwashing of what's going on Madison Avenue. And that's something our children, if they understand it, they'd laugh at it. It's not possible to be neutral just to say, okay, I'm not going to be influenced, but I'm not going to laugh at it. You can't do that. If you understand a joke, it's funny. And if you understand this type of joke, it's pathetic. If you understand it, you have to react like it's pathetic. If you don't think it's pathetic, you don't understand it. You have to go all the way. The reality, the truth. It's the best weapon against society nowadays. Sheltering is not enough. Any other questions? Thank you all for coming. Have a good night.